Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning to talk financial planning, keeping financial perspective during volatile times. And to lead us in that discussion is Joe Sullender, First Vice President, Wells Fargo Advisor, and fellow seminar presenter. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Bob.
It's been a while. It's been a good few months,
I think.
It's good to have you back. John Elliott. Benefit strategist, federal benefit strategist, ex-Fed, fellow seminar presenter, guest co-host. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Bob and Joe.
Good morning.
What's it been, 2 weeks, John? We didn't do one last week.
I don't know. August 22nd was when I was here. I remember that.
Okay. All righty. All righty, Joe. Let's just, we talked in the proverbial green room, but let's do this first. Talk me off the ledge here. I mean, we're in frothy times. Is that what you all say?
Sure.
With regards to the market, and you probably get a lot of calls saying, Joe, I missed the first downtick, and it came back. I want to miss another one. Get me out. How do you handle that?
I think what's happened the last really 10 years or 12 years or so is we've gone through two of the most severe downturns the market's ever seen. We've had, you know, 50% declines basically in the stock market in 2000 to 2002 and then again in 08, early 09. So now every time that market starts to teeter a little bit, and the news certainly doesn't help us, you know, you turn on the news for comfort, that's usually not going to help. And you start watching, looking for answers, and you just have that, people have that fear that here we go again, and I'm going to avoid this one. I'm going to get out this time. And I mean, my general thinking is that if you're going to be in volatile investments like stocks, you have to have an understanding of the risk that you're taking and understand that volatility so that you don't feel that tendency to pull out at the wrong time.
Okay, when people hear stocks, they hear different things. You know, there are stocks that are more volatile than other. What do you call that, the beta thing?
Mm-hmm, sure.
Okay, so it's more susceptible, or it's more risk, I guess. Mm-hmm. All right, but there are stocks that are, I guess, are kind of the proverbial steady ones. So when you assess a client and their risk tolerance, that can be in stocks, but stocks doesn't mean volatility per se. It have different shades of it.
And to be honest, when I say stocks, most of the time I'm talking about stock mutual funds, because those help to diversify the risk. And by having more than one stock, certainly if somebody has, you know, a portfolio of five individual companies, they could be taking an incredible amount of risk. But like you mentioned, with stats like beta, you can look at a mutual fund and see, well, when the market goes down 10%, how should my fund perform relative to that? And help understand, I think, one of the biggest issues is when the market does go down, is it going down? I mean, I'm sorry, when your accounts go down, is it going down because the markets are doing poorly or because your investments aren't good? You know, that your mutual funds are too risky. And that's an important distinction to make when you're making investment decisions.
Okay, but of course, on the flip side of that, the riskier ones might have better rewards on the upside.
No question. But nobody worries about it when it's going up, Bob.
How do you get, first meet a client, or what do you request from them before they come in? I guess we could go through three different age cycles, but in general, do you assess, you tell me what you assess.
If you're going to go see a financial planner, I don't know that you need to prepare too much before you go in. The point of going to see a financial planner is that you're hoping that they are going to do that work. But I do tell people to bring financial statements for TSP, their other investment accounts. And I think a pay stub is very useful to see, too, because one sort of, I think, mistake that people make is when they talk about what they're going to need when they retire, and you'll hear these sort of rules of thumb that say you need 90% of your income, you know, you're used to. I like to look at it on a net after-tax basis and really see, okay, what's your take-home pay? Because that's what we need to replace. You know, we don't need to replace, you know, the gross salary with all the deductions. We need to replace your take-home pay. So if I have someone's take-home pay and their statements – and they have a sense for their goals and what they want to do with their money, we can pretty much go from there.
Yeah,
if you're a heavy contributor to the thrift savings plan, you could do, if you're over 50, $22,000 this year to your thrift savings plan. You're not going to be able to do that in retirement. So if you're looking at your pension versus your net pay, I tell them that too. Look, get your latest pay stub. Multiply, that's 26 pay periods a year, then divide by 12 so you get your monthly net income. Compare that to your net annuity, bearing in mind there's no TSP contribution possible. There's no retirement contribution possible. There's no Social Security or Medicare tax. So Social Security and Medicare tax is what together about 7 point, well, not now because you got the 4.2, but none of that is coming out of your annuity check. So you've got to look at net-to-net comparison.
And then you add in that a lot of people have deductions taken from their paycheck to save in credit union or savings accounts. So you back that out. And sometimes if your annuity is going to be, you know, 50-60% maybe of what you were, you know, what you're receiving while you were working, a lot of times that's an equivalent take-home number, mm-hmm. depending on how much of a saver that you were.
Years ago, I don't know if you remember this, Joe, we were downtown and we did a session on Get Real about retirement dollars. It was at a hotel, mm-hmm. it was through Excellence in Government. And if you remember, we started at the back end. Where do you spend? Mm-hmm. You know, what do you need to keep your lifestyle going? And then we work the other. Okay, where's it coming from? Mm-hmm. And then we came up. It was very simplistic because it was an hour. And at the end of the day, it was, do we have a surplus or a deficit? In other words, are we going to be spending more than what we're going to bring in? But let's go back to, you know, we're meeting with you now, and we bring in our stuff, you know. And I'm sure you would love everybody to bring in a balance sheet, but I don't think that's going to happen. So
actually,
you're lucky to get it.
To be honest, Bob, as an accountant, you can appreciate, sometimes it's better if people don't organize it themselves. You know, the people that come in with spreadsheets that you have to figure out their logic.
Yeah.
You know,
very good.
I appreciate just the shoebox full of statements. That's perfectly okay.
I don't think I've ever heard that, but I understand it now because I'll have these folks that are inclined that way in a certain profession, and they'll have all this stuff and standard deviation, and I go, what's a standard deviation, and why do you have all these? What do you have?
Yeah.
So, okay, so you sit down with them and you see this. Do you try to get into maintaining their lifestyle, or mm-hmm. Let's take somebody mid-career. Beginning career, they probably should see you, but by mid-career, they definitely should see you.
Mm-hmm.
Are they spenders? You know, if they're spenders, they're not going to be savers. And if they're not saving, are they going to be able to make it from mid-career to the end zone,
mm-hmm.
so to speak, mm-hmm. Without a lot of bumps in the road? And how do you, can you see that? Can you see it by where the money's going, cars, clothes, houses, or rather than savings and a little car?
What I try to do is put it back in the client or whoever's meeting with me, put it back in their court. I can't, as a financial planner, I'm not going to sit down and say, you know, Bob, you go out to eat way too often. You know, you need to not do that, or you need to sell your car and buy an older car. I try to stay away from that. What I show them is, based on the path, and that's what I think is important in your mid-career, the path that you're heading is heading you towards this result. You can choose to change that direction if you want, and you have time to do that. So if you're saving at a slower clip, you may be working till 65. You know, you may not be able to fully fund college. You may be in these sort of situations. So if you don't want that to be the case, then we do have to save. And I can give them a number, you know, $500 a month more. And then it's up to the individual then to go back and figure out what they would cut. You know, what would they get rid of as far as spending goes?
All righty. For those of you that want to cut your angst, you can talk to Joe and you can talk to John. You can talk to me, too. 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. It's 10:15. It's Monday, September. September 12th, 2011. And we're going to be on live for about another 45 minutes, maybe 43 minutes. So don't call us after that time because we won't be here. But you can email us. We'll talk about the email in a while. But again, 202-465-3080. The focus certainly is on financial planning, but we're not unable to answer questions on benefits and even if you had a tax issue.
Taxes, too, yeah.
Okay. All righty, Joe. So let's get back to you're really somewhat like a shrink. I mean, I feel sometimes like I'm a shrink.
Yeah.
But money shrink is probably more so than a tax shrink.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to change their behavior if they need it, or it may be change their behavior if they're too much on the other side. They save before they eat.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever met many of those where they're just, you know, I got to put X dollars away, and after I do that, then I can buy groceries?
Actually, I was going to comment on that earlier when you were using the example of people who are falling short of their goals and aren't saving enough. I'd say 90%. I deal with federal employees, and sort of the 90% rule, I would say, with that group is people who are in too good a shape for their goals. And I know that sounds a little strange to say, but what I mean by that is they have in their head, I need to work until I'm 60 and I'm saving and saving and saving, when the reality is they could retire sooner if they wanted to. They could spend more money now if they wanted to. I even have clients that don't want to retire because they feel like that they wouldn't be able to save as aggressively in retirement. And you ask them, what are you saving for? And they have no answer. But so we can get addicted to savings as well as we can get addicted to spending. And what I try to do sort of as a financial planner is just show you, do what you want, but here's where the result will be. And is this the end result that you want? Not unlike a, kind of a personal trainer, I would guess, in the gym. You know? And then help them stay on that program and learn how to implement it properly and keep them on track.
Okay, I'm going to give you two questions. Can you get a saver to spend, and can you get a spender to save?
Not really. You can get a spender to quit spending so much and a saver to release that anxiety a little bit.
Back when I first entered the workforce, I grew up. I can't complain. I grew up in a blue-collar area and probably better off than most kids on the street, but not a lot. So I was one of those save before you eat when I got out of school. And my father used to, well, you let some moths grow out of your pocket. And it took a long time, but then I had some savings, so I felt a little bit better about spending a few more bucks. But I, you know, this is what you do, and then you buy groceries.
Right, right. It's hard to break that mentality. And I've, again, but in retirement, like this one couple I'm thinking of, they have, and they're probably listening going, oh, he's talking about me, but they have no children, and they were both under the old federal system, under CSRS, and they could actually probably live off one of the retirees' paychecks but in retirement, but they wouldn't retire because they felt like that they wouldn't be able to accumulate money at the rate that they were accumulating it. Well, for what? That was the question. I mean, they had almost, you know, seven figures basically put away, and, you know, what am I still saving for?
I see that a lot, with particularly with your CSRS, that people are heading towards the maximum where they get 42 years of service, 80% of their I-3. And actually, if you do the net-to-net comparison that we talked about earlier, then they're probably losing money by working probably before they hit the 42 years. But I see more and more of those people, it seems, in seminars or talk to them, or in email questions with that kind of service. And, you know, it's like, why are you still working?
I mean, if you love your job, sure.
Well, but, sure. That's the other thing. It's not all financial. If you'd really miss coming to work, then by all means keep working, because you've got to be happy. But if that's not the case, then and you can afford to retire and would like not to have to come to work, then by all means you should bail out as soon as possible.
And, Bob, you know, another place this comes into play, like with the FERS folks, particularly mid-career employees, is people have it ingrained in their minds that they should max out the TSP. And I fall prey to that. I'll say that loosely in seminars, and I'm sure, John, you and Bob, you probably say the same thing. But one thing I run into very often is people in their mid-career that have saved very aggressively in the TSP and done very well for their retirement and have an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old and have no education savings. And that's a case where the goals aren't quite lined up, where I'll run two separate forecasts. One is a retirement forecast, one's an education forecast. And I'll show them, you know, you're maxing out the TSP, which is great for tax purposes and growth and everything else, but you're in such good shape, almost too good a shape for when you really wanted to retire, and there's nothing here for the kids for their education. So,
do they ever say, well, I can borrow against the TSP to pay the college?
Oh, yeah. They go that route.
Okay, what's the response?
I would rather build the savings to where it's accessible, to where if you do borrow from the TSP, you do have to pay it back. I mean, and if you have a education account separate, which now with 529 plans particularly, education accounts grow tax-free. And so the ability to save, I'm not saying stop the TSP by any means. If you can save for education while you're maxing out the TSP, great. If for a handful of years you have to bring your TSP down a few thousand dollars to be able to fund an education account, I actually think it's worth considering.
Good point.
Because plus, if you don't pay that TSP loan back before you leave, then the thrift board will declare a taxable distribution of interest to the IRS.
And a penalty if you're under 59 and a half, correct?
There's a certain exclusion.
No, if you're if you leave the government in the year you turn 55 or over, there's a 10% tax penalty.
But assuming you're in your 40s or early 50s, then you might have a...
You could have an issue. Yeah, you're going to have a tax issue at a minimum. Yeah, you might not have a penalty issue.
Okay. But, that's excellent advice. I mean, every time, I hear financial planners on TV, on the Today Show, for example, you get to watch that when you retire, they'll say, don't borrow from your 401k. Well, your TSP is the same principle.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things with TV financial planners and radio, I guess, is what I am today. But
certain radio stations, not this one.
But you have to be. It's always tough when you're talking in a broad stroke, to a big group of people. And I'm always try to be real careful with that. That to say everyone should max out the TSP is generally true, but might not be true for the person listening. And I think that's the financial planning is very personalized and individualized. That's what you have to make sure you're aware of.
Okay. Do you ever hear, again, we're focusing in on mid-career because that's when people should be getting serious if they weren't serious before, because they can't get too serious 5 years before they retire. They go, well, TSP is part of my three-legged stool, and I know what my FERS annuity is probably going to be. I'm anxious about the COLA. Maybe they're going to ask for more money to contribute to the FERS fund. But my TSP is going to be the heavyweight, and I can't afford for it not to be the heavyweight because it might have to be half my income.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe they're more compelled to save. But you're right. In all savings, you have other obligations, and you mm-hmm. mentioned the couple with no kids. Well, they don't have that problem,
mm-hmm.
but probably more do have that. I won't say problem, that issue.
Mm-hmm.
Than the others. And then on the 529s, I'm not a 529. I understand the tax ramifications of it, but, is the Ohio one better than the Wyoming one better than the New Hampshire one? I don't know. Mm-hmm. And so people here, now I understand the show is just not local, but around here, I want the Maryland fund if I'm a Marylander. I want the Virginia. And I go, maybe you'll get a tax deduction, but you might forego the tax deduction to get the better rate of return. Do you ever have that conversation with the folks?
All the time, actually. There's a website called savingforcollege.com that people can go to, and it used to be a fabulous resource until they started charging for a lot of their expertise. But what you can do is see every state's 529 plan and at least which fund family they're affiliated with. So I always tell people the first place to start, really, to where it's going to matter the most is that you're going to have successful investment performance in the account. The state tax deduction is great, but in some states it might put $100 in your pocket. So if you're putting, five, six, maybe even six figures into an education account, a big chunk of money that you're saving, how it grows is going to be the most important factor. And so Virginia and Maryland here locally happen to have two of the top rated 529 plans in the country. So we're lucky in that respect. So if you're a Virginia or Maryland resident, you can use your home state's plan, get the state tax deduction, have good investments too. But there's other states that their plans aren't so good. And I work with lots of people in those states. And a lot of times we use Virginia and Maryland's plans.
Yeah. And the other, I think, misconception people have is if I live in Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania, wherever, North Dakota, and I'm in that fund, then my kid has to go to school in that state.
Right.
That's not true, is it?
Not at all. Not at all. Not at all. The only restrictions you may run into is there's about a half dozen states that won't let you invest in their plan if you don't live there. But across the board, Virginia's plan, you can use Virginia's plan, live in Colorado, and the kid go to school in California.
Okay. So we've talked about the mid-career person with and without children. We talked about college funding. And I guess whatever stage somebody's in, there's always this mythical, I have to have the rainy day fund.
Mm-hmm.
I have to have my emergency fund. How much should be set, not dollar-wise, but should it be based on annual income, a half of annual income, a quarter of annual, or as in both of you all said, income is not the issue, it's the spending. Mm-hmm. So if we're going to have an emergency fund, what do you work with?
This is where I'm going to get myself in trouble here a little
bit. Well, we don't want to do that.
Because I have a little different philosophy than some. There are, again, I don't like rules of thumb, you know, where they say every single person in America should have 6 months worth of living expenses in the bank. I think you should have whatever you feel comfortable having. And because a lot of today's world, you have money in mutual funds, that's not considered an emergency fund. Or if you have money in stocks or CDs, that's not considered an emergency fund, but it is liquid. You know, if you had some devastating emergency, you could get at that money. So what worries me when I see you need 6 months of living expenses is a 27-year-old listening to this radio program thinking, well, I mean, it's going to take them forever to accumulate when you're just starting out with, you know, trying to buy your first house or maybe newly married or having babies. How in the world are you going to save 6 months worth of living expenses? And where are you going to put it? In the bank, where it's going to earn very little when you're in early parts of your life where you could really be doing something better with it and probably won't have the emergency anyway. So I tend to say whatever you feel comfortable with. And also I have the luxury of working with federal employees who have a little different job security situation, you know, than somebody who works at a, you know, a small company in the area.
Hmm. Okay. Can we take a little detour on insurance? Now, I don't sell insurance. I don't know if you sell insurance. But when you look at somebody's needs, life insurance. I have clients, and again, I don't sell it, but I just use sometimes a common sense, and I never forget this one. And the dollar amount, if I said it would be significant, but this person made significant money. So this is how much I have in life insurance. And I go, well, that's about a fourth of what you need. What do you mean? Mm-hmm. I said, well, you have X number of children and you're X age. And if you go, that a huge income stream is going to go.
That's funny. Usually it's the other way. It's people have, well, what is all this insurance for? I had one couple I met with that said that their kids could go to college as long as one of them passed away before they went to college. They said otherwise they weren't going to be able to make it work. But I try to look at, for most people, I think with what the federal government offers, which John can, you know, add to, you can buy, you know, a significant amount of life insurance there with the government. I tend to believe that that provides most of what you would need. Some people with other extenuating circumstances may need to go buy more. If you do buy more insurance, I am a big believer in term insurance, that it makes the most sense. Your typical federal employee retires, whatever age they are. They've got their annuity coming in. They can choose a fairly inexpensive survivor benefit on that and have their TSP that their spouse or any other dependents can use if they pass away. So I don't really see the need to have huge amounts of life insurance in retirement. So I'm not a big fan of the whole life or universal life policies that you pay more now to keep them all throughout retirement.
In regards to the whole life, now, for those of you all listening, term insurance is basically your renting insurance, and it's very inexpensive relative to what's called whole life, and the whole life premium's higher, but it's a savings as well, and it kind of sets the premium over a period of time. And it may not have a lot of cash value initially, but the idea there's some estate planning issues there too.
Sure.
So that do you find sometimes that whole life might deserve a second look? The older the person is, or the younger the person is, or in between?
I use whole life very heavily. You hit on one word in there, estate planning. I think that's one place where it hits, where it can have a very big impact to pay estate taxes in larger estates. You know, for instance. As far as younger or older, I haven't really thought that as far as running into whether that would make more sense. I would probably lean younger just because with older folks, the whole life premiums are so high and the need for insurance usually at that stage, and I'm stereotyping here, but isn't as high maybe as it was when they were younger.
Yeah, that's what I deal with when I get to the insurance portion of my seminar. I say, look critically at your life insurance needs, because typically, and it's a generalization as you pointed out, as we age, the need for a lot of insurance largely goes away. Term insurance, which means basically you die, some your designated beneficiaries get paid. That's term insurance. That's what Fegley is. is good when you have young kids, mm-hmm. and you don't want your premature death to have your spouse have to sell the house because he or she can't afford payments, and you'd like to have money for your kids' education. But as we survive and age, then a lot of those needs are met through other investments. Mm-hmm. The college gets paid for. Maybe they're through college. The house is either paid off, or that mortgage that seems so big in the beginning is now seems like hardly anything. So term insurance is, I think, definitely for the young. And by the way, since we were mentioning Fegley, which is, of course, the government-sponsored life insurance program, more and more feds have found out, including yours truly, that you can buy cheaper term insurance outside of Fegley, mm-hmm. and it can be significant savings, and I found that out personally, that I was able to buy an equal amount of term insurance that I had with Fegley, and at the time I had, of course, the basic and then five times option B, so I had like six times my salary. And so did my spouse, and then we shopped around and did very well in terms of saving privately, going a private insurance company, a major insurance company.
Okay.
Saved a lot of money.
I'm not prying, but I found that if the individual is a member of a professional society, oftentimes they have an insurance carrier that's very interested in doing business with it. It might be engineers, it might be attorneys, it might be scientists, it might be accountants. Mm-hmm. And those premiums are extremely reasonable and carry through to past age 65, I think, into the early 70s, a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
And very inexpensive term. Of course, it increases with age, but...
I think the key statement to say about insurance, though, is when you're buying insurance, life insurance is to protect an income stream. And that you know, it's if I have three kids, if I pass away tomorrow and my wife is home with the three kids, we would need replacement, you know, some funds to replace that, to replace the income loss that she would have with me passing away. A retired federal couple with annuities and a TSP, you don't really have that need. So I think it's just all about, it's not insurance is good or bad or right or wrong. It's again, it's, does it fit you? Does it replace an income stream? Is that what you need?
You, I think, made the comment either the last time or the time before, and it has not been forgotten. Financial planning is a succession of moving parts. So for those of you all listening, we're moving through some parts, but they all mesh.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we may have started off with, well, let's look at this and what we got into college funding. We're talking about life insurance. We're talking about risk tolerance. We're talking about getting off the, what do you call it, the roof in today's environment. And so, and we even talked a little bit about taxes. Now, sometimes with taxes, people, you all are going to just roll your eyes with this. I do the reverse. Somebody said, well, you know, I want to do this. I want to spend X dollars. And I said, well, do you know how much you have to make to have X dollars to spend? You go, what do you mean? And so I said, well, you're in this tax bracket and state bracket. Then you got FICA, maybe, maybe not. You got Medicare, certainly. And you got some other issues. So it could sometimes be twice as much when you add all that stuff together. Mm-hmm. Then what you're spending. So you mean if I spend $100, I have to make $200? I go, yep.
Mm-hmm.
And a few of the married ones, the spouses hate me. Because and now the shopping mentality is totally different.
Right.
Anyway, so I'm sure you don't do that, but I do. All righty. Then if we're talking about investment profile, and you define their risk. We talked about this before we went on air. You know, you look at risk tolerance. Do you find that people, their risk tolerance, they might be very non-risk oriented early on and become a little bit less stringent later in life, or do they carry the same trait?
They probably should do it the other way. You know, you should probably be more comfortable with risk when you're younger because you have the time, you know, to see the different economic cycles wash themselves out. I think one, if you will say, benefit from the last 10 years and all of the market volatility that we've had is that I think a lot of people kind of have defined their risk tolerance. I think there's many people I know that would could tell you they know the day when they breached it. And I think that was difficult to define in the 90s when the market went straight up all the time. And in fact, I shouldn't even say it went straight up all the time. There were 20-30% corrections all throughout the 90s, but people didn't blink at them because they would last 2 months and you'd make your money back. You know, we've been through serious corrections in the last 10 years, and that's where risk tolerance gets tested. And it's difficult to know when you haven't been through something like that, which a lot of people hadn't up until the last 10 years, to know exactly how you're going to feel about it.
Do you find sometimes that risk tolerance is more psychological than monetary? For example, somebody that maybe has saved enough and it, you know, the value of the investments go down, but for them to retire or for them to live the projected life, it doesn't make any difference.
I'd say it's not just more psychological. I think it might all be psychological for a lot of people. I tell the story in my seminars about how when the market went through the big downturn from the end of 08 to March or so of 09, where it lost about half of its value, and I had panicked people coming into my office going, okay, well, what do we do? And I'd say, well, do you still want to retire in 2 years? And they would look at me like I was crazy. You know, how in the world am I supposed to retire now? And I would run the math on their plan and find that they could still retire in a couple of years because they had the bedrock of their federal retirement check that was still intact. And if the TSP dropping 20-30% or whatever it was enough to change all their plans, then probably we shouldn't have been that aggressive in the first place. And what I found was, is when you would show people, you make that leap from, no one wants to see their TSP go down 20% or whatever the number is, but we don't want to make that leap to, well, now I can't retire, put my kids through school, do all these things. And if you have a financial plan, you'll know if that actually is true. And that's really what I think the biggest key of a financial plan is to give you that perspective of knowing where do you really stand in the face of market volatility.
Okay, we've shown the light on the TSP. Let's talk about FERS folks. Same thing, mid-career, maybe advanced mid-career. And they go, Joe, you know, everything we've done is great. I'm very happy. But now I'm nervous about Social Security. Will it be means-tested? Is it going to be flatlined with maybe an occasional COLA, semi-annual COLA, or whatever? Do you get into that discussion yet? And I hate to put that into anybody's head because then they'll call you afterwards and say, Joe, why don't we talk about that?
Well, particularly I think in the upcoming election, we're going to hear plenty about that as we already have in some of the debates. But, you know, for the younger folks, I have no problem if it makes them more comfortable with their plan taking the Social Security number out. You know, I hate to just wave the white flag and say we don't expect it to be. But if I meet somebody that's 40 or younger who says, you know, okay, my plan works, that's great, but I feel like it's relying on Social Security. And, you know, you've seen the news. You see what they're saying about the funding of the system and where it's headed. If you wanted to back that out and just protect yourself against that, I don't see any real problem with that. If somebody comes in at 61 and says, I don't want to count for Social Security, I think that might be a little dramatic.
Push your retirement date back.
You know, so, but I don't know if that's what you were asking.
No, that's a great answer. Okay, fine. Let's take it off the table.
Yeah.
This is how we're going to get to the goal. And if we get it, it's icing on the cake.
Yeah, I think that's good advice in any case, even if we don't fix Social Security. And Social Security is easily fixable. We know where the moving parts are. It's just that we've lacked the political, or not we, but our representatives have lacked the political will to do so, and it's used as a political football to threaten one party or the other. But that said, I think that's it's a good idea in the best of times to take Social Security off the table, but it'll be there. I mean, they can't say, well, you paid these payroll taxes all this year, and now you're not going to get anything. Well, that's absurd. I mean, there really would be, this would make the Greece riots look like a picnic, a day at the beach, if they ever did that.
All righty. For those of you who are joining us late, we're with Joe Sullender, First Vice President, Wells Fargo Advisors. Of course, Joe is a financial planner, fellow seminar presenter, and expert with the federal government employee, right?
Yeah, that sounds good.
And John Elliott, federal benefit strategist, retired Fed, fellow seminar presenter, answers emails, does the show. Just to remind people who they're listening to, and I'm Bob Lines, but I'm an accountant type, so I just kind of I'm in between somewhere. All right, let's come back to the topic. Topic is keeping financial perspective during volatile times. And we really pounded on the mid-career, talked about a little bit about the beginning career. But I'd imagine, correct me if I'm wrong, Joe, do the majority of your calls come from somebody pre-retirement, 10 years out or closer? The anxiousness calls.
It's a little of both, to be honest. Really? I'd have to say probably the most prevalent area I get is the people that are a year or two away from retirement. That's probably the primary ones because they're going from, we talked earlier about the mindset of a saver, you know, somebody who's save. It's a very big leap for those people, I think, to transition themselves psychologically into retirement. And then you get right on that doorstep and your TSP goes down 20%. That can cause a lot more anxiety than somebody very, very young or somebody that's retired that may have reduced the risk of their portfolio or is not relying on it, you know. And so that's probably the place where most of those particular phone calls come from. Not that we don't hear them from everyone.
The others, but I would assume that they would be more anxious. Again, if they're the old system and it went down 20%, I never say, well, you know, it's not that big a deal. You say, well, it's not as much as you think it's going to be because the bulk's coming from this other pocket.
Right.
And I'm not going to get a COLA. I go, well, but you also are going to get an annuity.
And that's why analyzing risk, it's amazing to me when people analyze investments. Take something like a mutual fund. The way most the average citizen picks a mutual fund is on returns. People don't have the same sort of insight into looking at a fund based on risk. And you've got to know what kind of risk you're taking if you're a few years away from retirement, because you might have a big negative surprise. I mean, this shouldn't be a surprise. When the market does have volatility, and there are periods of time where it goes down. We don't know when they're going to be, but they're going to happen. So we should know before we put any money in any investment to not get enticed by the bigger returns, but to also understand the volatility and make sure that it's appropriate for our time frame.
All righty. I read some of your trade rags. I'm not so sure I understand them all. I should say trade publications. And the trade publications will talk about the beta thing on an up market and a down market, you know. And so I'll look and say, well, where's the one that's got a B and a B or a B and a C? So, you know, A would be, you know, you're very safe, and F would be stay away from this one if you're figuring it's going to go the wrong way. Is there, I'm not asking you to divulge any information that you would have, but are there houses that kind of analyze this and they would have it for any mutual fund or any big mutual fund where they do the both sides?
Morningstar is probably the best place to go. They're a third-party company out of Chicago that has a website that puts the raw data of the mutual fund up on their website.
Mm-hmm.
I use it. I mean, that's where I would go to get the information, because if you just call Vanguard and say, send me info on your U.S. growth fund, they're going to send you a prospectus that's in legal jargon that, you know, exactly, and a glossy one-page sheet about how great the fund is. So it's hard to kind of, if you can get some expertise in kind of dissecting the facts of the fund, something like a beta, you can go on Morningstar and see the raw data. Here's what the beta is. Here's what the fund expenses are. Here's the 1, 3, 5, and 10-year track record and make a better decision.
Very good. Morningstar, I mean, can anybody go on that or just...
Yeah, they do have, I believe, off the top of my head, there's some of their site that you have to pay for, but there is enough of it for the typical investor to be able to glean some good information that is free.
Because you do see that a lot in ads for mutual funds. Morningstar rated, and do they give it by stars?
Yeah, they do. They do star ratings for the funds, but hopefully, I mean, you take it one step further and really... And look at the data, I think, would make more sense than just making sure you have all 5-star rated funds.
Okay. And also, because, you know, you're working with a professional like you, I think people need to at least understand a little bit more than they did before they walked into your office what they're doing. shouldn't they? I mean, some of them have great faith, and they should. But others should say, okay, thanks, Joe. Now I understand it better.
Well, I think there's different types of financial planners. What I've always tried to do is doing seminars. I'm a teacher. So I try to take the time with the people that are investing with me as their planner. to educate them on what they're doing and what they're actually investing in. And it's worked better for me over my career, because then when we go through difficult times, they understand what we're in. You know, it's not a sales thing, you know, where you're selling a fund to somebody and look at the 20% returns and they call next year and go, I lost 5%. What happened? So I think the understanding didn't have to necessarily be there the day you start, but I, hopefully most planners will take the time, I think, to explain to you what you're investing in.
Okay, I'm not going to ask you to divulge any trade secrets, but when you teach a course, at the end of the course, what would you like the person to walk out with that they didn't walk in with?
I want people, that's a great, great question, by the way. I want people to have a sense for their long-term plans and to be able to, what I would love for people to do is filter out the noise they hear on television and read in the newspaper and not react to it. You know, I did one seminar just recently where during lunch, I went, it was the market, it was one of those days, the market was down 500 points or whatever. I went out during lunch, turned on CNBC to listen to what was happening. I have this satellite radio thing where you can hear CNBC in the car, and CNBC was the people, the tone was frenetic. I mean, everybody were freaking out. And then they said, okay, we're going to come to commercials. We're going to cut to commercial. We'll be right back. Three straight commercials for buying gold. And I just thought, how does the average investor navigate this? You know, they watch CNBC, the stock market's down. Oh, my goodness, everyone on TV is going bananas. And then I could buy gold and make 50% every year. You know, it's. I think, if anything, I want people to take that message from my seminars, is to have a long-term plan and be able to stay calm and ride this thing out during for their lives, and hopefully not stress themselves out about money and enjoy their lives doing other things.
But boy, I should go to one of your courses. Can I sit in on one of yours? And then John, I don't understand anything John talks about. He talks the whole day. So what's your goal?
What's my goal?
When you have the person walk out of there, what do you want them to walk out?
Okay. My goal is you learn something you didn't know. And that sounds kind of, I don't know, simplistic.
No,
but it really isn't.
No.
And a lot of people will come up to, not a lot, but a number of people over the years have come up to me after the seminar and said, you know, I really feel better about my ability to retire, than I did before. And I had one person, I think it was a CSRS seminar, doesn't matter, but it was FERS actually, and I told him about the net-to-net comparison, and, you know, he learned some things. And he came back from lunch, and he said, based on what I heard this morning, I can retire 2 years earlier than I thought I could. And that's kind of a good feeling for both of us.
Mm-hmm.
So we try and tell them things they don't know. And I would venture to say that every federal benefits portion of the seminar, there's not one person in the audience that hasn't learned something they didn't know. So
when you travel
outside
the proverbial beltway, and we travel the country and even outside the country doing these seminars, do you find when they get outside the beltway, the more basic questions they have, and maybe some of them didn't even know that they had an annuity?
Yeah, that happens, and I notice that in the emails, because I get emails from all over the country, and you can tell not only do they have not, they haven't been to a seminar, they may not have access to a seminar, or they're, you know, just didn't know they could bug their agencies to finance a seminar or whatever. But I get a lot of questions where there's a lot of, you can tell they really don't know much of anything about their retirement benefits. So, yeah, particularly I would say outside the beltway, that's probably even more true. Although I've had inside the beltway, I've had a couple people in FERS classes that didn't know they had a FERS annuity. They just thought it was Social Security and the TSP.
Maybe they came
from the private sector where there was a 401k, and then, of course, you're covered by Social Security. There's no pension. So I had an attorney I get a pension too? Said, yes, you do. That's what I'm talking
deal.
About right now.
How exciting.
Made their day. Okay, no, that's, I like your perspective and your answers, because I really think federal employees, you know, around here, it's just at every street corner, the information course. The best place to go is NITP, but there are I think there are other firms.
Somewhere.
Somewhere.
Yes. But we sell nothing except knowledge. Some of those firms, we should add, do sell insurance, for example, or other.
We don't sell anything.
No.
Nor will we. Okay, so stage of the career, beginning, mid. Now, are many of your clients retired feds?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, so, I mean, we can march through, but oftentimes these shows stop at retirement. But when they come in after retirement.
I'd say probably over half, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, are they just as focused on their investments and the pension? I'm not going to say they don't worry about it. They know it's coming.
Mm-hmm.
It might not get a COLA. Maybe it'll get a CLIP. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's coming.
Mm-hmm.
But the investments, you have to care and feed them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you got to feed them, but you got to care them. You just clip the branches on the trees. And what do you do with those folks?
The retired folks.
Yeah.
There's two types of retired feds, I would say, in my mind, is the ones that are living off of their investments, that need those to supplement their annuity. And then there's a whole group that don't and use that money if they have anything bigger, extra, maybe buying a car, going on a trip, doing something like that with the money. So there's two very different roads. And the typical Fed retiree that's living off of the money, then you have to be very careful with how you invest the money to keep the volatility to a minimum, because we are going to need to make withdrawals from this. The retiree that isn't living off of the money, then you have to assess, what is their likely need for this? Are they going to be accessing this? If they realistically aren't going to be using the money, they're probably really leaving it for their next generation. Then you can be more aggressive with it and not get caught up in the market, and what happens in the short term, or take more risk.
Do you ever either get a split federal couple, not that everybody's a couple, one private industry or not mm-hmm. not pensioned, and the other one, and there has to be a pot of money, or just you get somebody that just has never been a Fed and they're going to live off a pot of mm-hmm. change?
And some Fed retirees are maybe have been here 6-7 years and it was their second or third career, and their annuity isn't going to pay their bills. So
Right. There's
always – that's why what John said and we talked about earlier about – looking at what your net pay is relative to what your annuity is the first step, because then you can figure out what column you go in. What gap do you have? If you don't have a gap at all, then you're in one group of things you can do with your investments. If you barely have any annuity and you're going to need heavy income from your investments, then we have to treat the investments very differently.
Okay, for the person that doesn't have an annuity or a very small one, mm-hmm. because like you say, just had been here a few years, do you ever look at buying annuities on the private side for them, or do you stay away from that?
Boy, you bring that up with 5 minutes to go. I could go into annuities forever. I'm very cautious with annuities. Let me just put it this way, is that I'm not against annuities, as I can sell them as part of my practice, and I have used them in certain places. But I think people have to be very careful. Annuities are sold with a lot of bells and whistles that sound extremely appealing, that very often costs them quite a bit of money internally in the annuity. And so if you're talking about buying a variable or fixed annuity, really variable annuities is what most people are attracted to, you have to read the fine print. That's kind of all I'll say if you want.
No, that's perfect. But that's kind of what I wanted you to say, those words, but I wanted you to say, no, you just don't go out and buy an annuity.
And certainly if it sounds, if they say, oh, we'll give you a set income for the rest of your life that can never go down, and if the market goes down, we'll give you all your money back. And just read the fine print. That's the main point. Now, it's kind of like all insurance. Is it worth paying 0.5% a year to have those guarantees? Maybe it is for you. But I think very often I run into people. I probably get more emails and phone calls from out of the area from people about annuities, where local advisors have gotten a hold of them or salespeople and said, you should buy this annuity. And they send me all the details. And I'll email them back and say, well, here's all the costs of this annuity. Here's the benefits of it. Here's really how it works. And I can't even think of one time where somebody went, oh, well, this is what I wanted. A lot of times people don't don't pull the look under the hood, if you will, of what's going on in an annuity.
And they're extremely hard to understand.
They really are.
I'm sure you do. I'd look at it and go.
In fact, as I was saying that, I was thinking, now I'm encouraging people to email me their annuity things. And believe me, it takes me as a professional planner a half hour
to sort
it out.
You don't have an email, do you? Not for annuities.
I do have an email.
What is that
email? Give that to you. It's my name, which is joseph.sullender, and that's S as in Sam, U-L-L-E-N-D-E-R, at wellsfargoadvisors.com.
Do that one more time.
All right, joseph.sullender. S-U-L-L-E-N-D-E-R at wellsfargoadvisors.com.
And do not send annuity questions. Anything else financial? He's fine. John, we got about a little bit, minute and a half or so. Final comments?
Well, I find that very few, and this always surprises me, federal employees have looked at the various calculators available to them, the Thrift Savings Plan as a calculator at TSP.gov. Mm-hmm. And if you're not using that, you're flying blind with your TSP account. It just using the calculator is an education in itself, not only about how much money you'll have, but how soon you'll have it. And it teaches the miracle of compounding interest. And you can use that to translate that into a TSP annuity, which I'm not bullish on, but mm-hmm. you can, and or monthly payments, which is not an annuity. But it suffice to say, it's a real eye-opener. And then there's other types of annuities. OPM has a FERS and CERS calculator, and Social Security has a Social Security calculator. You should use those in your financial planning.
Okay, talking about Social Security, next week, Lester Austin, he's got some nerve. He's coming in, but he's a gentleman, and he's got answers, and he'll give them to you. And the week after that, the TSP boys will be in here, and we'll be talking about the Roth TSP, as well as you're going to meet the director, if you haven't before, and Tom Tribuco, the lead person, I guess, PR guy. Anyway, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.